Okay, what I'd like to discuss now is the war in Lebanon. Now it's known as the First Lebanon War because one broke out later, but the war in Lebanon that more or less brought about the end of Menachem Begin's reign as Prime Minister in Israel. So we had said earlier that the PLO had first set up operations in Jordan and they tried to even overthrow King Hussein. He waged a war against them, drove them out of the country. In the process, he killed more Palestinians in 1 month, later on known as Black September, than Israel has in the last 70 some odd years. Now, following Black September, the PLO recreated and expanded its terrorist infrastructure in Lebanon. They also got backing from Syria. Syria decided to use the pretext of the civil war that was going on between the Muslims and the Christians to sort of move into Lebanon and decide that Lebanon was really part of southern Syria. Hafez al-Assad was determined to gradually swallow up the country. So with his backing, the PLO is now raining upon Israel and causing all sorts of problems. Let's see. Now, the situation got so bad for the Israelis living in the northern part of the country that many of them had fled. Many of them had to live in bomb shelters. What happened was as follows. In 1981, in July of 1981, the United States was able to broker a ceasefire between all sorts of PLO attacks and Israeli reprisals. But then, in the 11 months after that, the PLO repeatedly violated the ceasefire. They were charged with 270 terrorist acts in Israel. In this time period, 29 Israelis died, 300 were wounded. Meanwhile, they were building up a force. They had about 18,000 PLO members that were on the borders there of Lebanon shooting down into Israel with attacks. They had another 5,000-6,000 militia from other countries all around. Israel, in their reprisal raids, found that they had such a cache of weapons that they could have armed five brigades. There were Russian-made T-34 tanks in the area. There were Katyusha rockets, anti-aircraft network. There were arsenals of mortars, and this was causing a fantastic threat to Israel, as I said, making life for Jews living in the north unbearable. As Henry Kissinger, who at this point was no longer Secretary of State in America, put it, no sovereign state can tolerate indefinitely the buildup along its border of a military force dedicated to its destruction and implementing its objectives by periodic shellings and raids. And Israel certainly felt that they were getting to the point where they could no longer just go on business as usual. The tipping point, however, the final provocation was the attempted assassination of Israel's ambassador to Great Britain, Shlomo Argov. Okay, Abu Nidal, which is a Palestinian terrorist group, sorry, there was a Palestinian terrorist group led by Abu Nidal. They, with backing of Iraq, they attempted an assassination of the ambassador to England, shot him in the head. He was in a coma. He never fully recovered. He ended up spending the rest of his life in a hospital. He lived for another 20 years, but he couldn't walk. Later on, he went blind. So this attempted assassination was the final straw. And on July 4th, I'm sorry, June 4th, 1982, the IDF attacked Lebanon. They moved 80,000 troops into Lebanon in what was known as Mibtza Shalom LeGalil, Operation Peace for the Galil. Now, the Minister of Defense for Israel was Ariel Sharon. And Sharon convinced Begin it would be necessary to take out the Syrian anti-aircraft batteries in the Bekaa Valley that was limiting Israel's Air Force operations. Over the course of 2 days, starting on June 7th, Israeli bombers knocked out all the Syrian batteries. Syrian MiGs tried to intercept, but Israel shot down 22 of them. Following day, another 24 Syrian planes were downed. After several days of dogfights, the Syrians had lost almost 100 planes, while every single Israeli plane returned safely. At this point, Assad decided to keep his troops out of the fighting, and Israel now had to only worry about the PLO in Lebanon. Syria was no longer a threat. Now, just as an interesting side point, the United States was thrilled to see what was going on, because their American-made aircrafts were now going up against Russian anti-aircraft batteries. And true, Israel always made modifications on whatever plane they got, and they clearly have very skilled pilots, but the United States certainly came away pleased with how the American-made planes fared against the Russian-made equipment that was being used by Syria and Lebanon. Now, the PLO what happens now, and this is what really brings an end to the war in Lebanon, Ariel Sharon pushes deeper and deeper, not just the initial buffer zone, which would be safe for the Israeli families living in the north, but he felt that we needed to really teach them a lesson and to move closer to Beirut, to basically help the Christians overthrow the Muslims in their civil war. At one point, September 16th, going into 17th, 1982, the Israeli troops allowed Lebanese Christian phalangist militia into the Beirut area refugee camp. These refugee camps, two of them were known as Sabra and Shatila. And the idea, at least is what they said, was that they were going to root out the Palestinian terrorist cells that were located there. It was estimated that 200 armed men were operating out of the bunkers that were built there over the years, stocked with lots of ammunition. And the Israelis said they gave the Christians permission to go in there and root out these 200 some odd terrorist men that were located there. But what happened was the Christian phalangists went on a killing spree. They were settling old scores with the Palestinians, going back to the civil war that's been going on since 1975, and especially avenging the murders of Lebanese president Bashir Gemayel and 25 of his followers who had been killed in a bomb attack earlier that week. When the soldiers ordered the phalangists out, they found hundreds dead. Now, the estimates are anywhere between 460, according to Lebanese police, to 700 to 800, calculated by Israeli intelligence. The dead included, by the Lebanese account, 35 women and children. The rest were men, Palestinian, Lebanese, Pakistanians, Iranians, Syrians, Algerians, all these militia that had come to wage war. Now, this massacre at Sabra and Shatila shocked the world. But the number of dead was actually only a tiny fraction of the estimated 95,000 casualties that occurred during the Civil War in Lebanon from 75 to 82. But yet the media would not let this go. Israel had allowed the phalangists to enter the camp as part of a plan to transfer authority to the Lebanese and accept responsibility for that decision. Israel set up, after the outcry from not just the United Nations, but the United States, and not just the non-Jewish United States, but even rabbis like Rav Soloveitchik felt that what happened here was immoral, they set up a Khan Commission of Inquiry formed by the Israeli government in response to the public outrage. And the Khan Commission found that Israel was indirectly responsible for not anticipating the possibility of the phalangist violence. Israel instituted the panel's recommendations, including the dismissal of Defense Minister Ariel Sharon and General Rafael Eitan. Rafael Eitan, I think we might have mentioned earlier, was one of the most highly decorated soldiers in Israel's history. He took part in 56, in the fighting in Mitla, and in 67 and 73. He was a general, I think I might have mentioned, that always wanted to be on everything. And when commandos were going on raids, he would say, "I want to go with you," and they would tell him the wrong time. He would show up at the airfield and say, "Get 0300 hours, ready for the mission," only to find out they left like 2 hours earlier, because all, you know, last thing Israel needed was for a general to fall into enemy's hands. Rafael Eitan, Rabina tells the story, that he was such an amazing warrior that once in the middle of a prolonged gunfight, he had terrible stomach problems, and he felt the need to have to, you know, he had like shulshul. He just took a dagger, a knife, and ripped open his pants and squatted and continued shooting and fighting while he had to relieve himself. This was like, you know, kulo soldier, totally for, you know, fighting for Israel, protecting Israel. But right now, Sharon, Minister of Defense, Raful, the Chief of Staff, the Ramatkal, both of them are dismissed. Now, it's interesting on so many different levels. When this happened, Begin remarked, "Goyim kill Goyim, and Jews are blamed." I mean, Jews were blamed to the point that Ariel Sharon was put on trial in Belgium, in absentia, and found guilty, while they never ever thought about putting the Falangist leader who led this massacre on trial. Just Ariel Sharon who allowed them to enter. Okay, but this is what happened. Like as I said, it was an outrage. Now, in contrast to Sabra and Shatila, in 1985, when Muslim militia attacked the same Shatila and a different Palestinian refugee camp, killing 635, wounding 2,500, not a peep was said. When over this time, Syria-backed Shiite militia and the PLO killed more than 2,000 people, many civilians, once again, nothing was stated. But by September 20th, after Sabra and Shatila, the United States, Italy, France all agreed to send troops back into Beirut to act as peacekeeping troops and more or less put an end to the Lebanon war. Just more contrast, 1990, while the world was distracted by events in Kuwait, which would end up leading to the Gulf War, Syrian troops overran the Beirut stronghold of the Christian Falangists. Okay? This is like revenge for what happened earlier. Approximately 700 people were massacred in the fighting, which eliminated the last remaining threat to Syrian dominance of Lebanon. Unlike what happened after Sabra and Shatila, once again, no international outcry was heard. A few months later, the Lebanese president went to Damascus to sign a treaty that allowed Syria to keep its troops in his country. Shortly before the treaty was signed, Syrian defense minister predicted two countries would soon be unified. Okay, and even later, from 2011 to 2016, when there was a Syrian civil war, 500,000 people were killed in the most grotesque ways, chemical weapons, and once again, no public outcry. As Begin said, when Jews are involved, that's when the world gets, you know, looks down upon all this innocent civilians. This basically put an end to Menachem Begin. He resigns a year later, September 1983. The demands for fighting grew louder. Israel had left a token force in Lebanon to help the SLA, the Southern Lebanese Army, and Begin couldn't take it. The war cost was costly. Over 1,200 soldiers died just between 1982 and 1985 in Lebanon. Begin quits, never really explains why. People assume it's that he was furious at being deceived by Sharon about the aims of the war. He was heartsick over the casualties, and his beloved wife, Eliza, passed away only a few months earlier. All of this could have weighed upon him. He resigns, and he basically lives as a recluse for the remainder of his life. For the last decade, he receives very few visitors, and he dies in February 1993. I'd like to end today's class just reading for you parts from Daniel Gordas' book about Menachem Begin. He says Menachem Begin's life was a study in the possibilities of both and, rather than either or. Begin, basically what he's trying to say, he encompassed opposing character traits, and he did in his life so many contradictory things that one would have a hard time saying that one person could have done so many different things. He was born into war, and yet he never gave up the hope for peace. He was forced into hiding upon declaring the revolt. His greatest moments, however, were in public, in front of adoring crowds. He was animated and energized by the citizens who rallied behind him. And yet, as we said before, he spent the last decade of his life out of their sight, as if hiding from them. He was hunted by the British as terrorist number one, and yet he was rewarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He made peace with Egypt, and yet he was attacked by Iraq. I'm sorry, he attacked Iraq, Iraq's nuclear reactor, as we spoke about, and he invaded Lebanon. He was capable of emotional highs, of great emotional highs, but he was also dogged by periods of great lows, willing to use force to expel the British. He was also among the chief protectors of the rule of law in the Jewish state. Fiercely and uniquely devoted to the Jews, he also gave refuge to Vietnamese boat people and urged the end of military rule over Israel's Arabs. Having avoided a civil war over the firing on the Altalena, he threatened to go to civil war in the battle over reparations, German reparations, after the Holocaust. And he brought Israel to the brink of it once again when he ordered the evacuation of Yamit in Sinai. By no means was he medaktik in his observance of mitzvot, and yet he both loved and honored Jewish tradition. As Minister Dan Maridor put it, Menachem Begin spoke Jewish. Among much else, Begin taught the Jews that love of their tradition was by no means exclusively the province of the ritually observant, that the rich and that the religious secular distinction, that tichiloni distinction, Israeli life, could be rendered meaningless by people with a profound knowledge and love for Jewish texts and rituals. And yet, despite this, there was also one unwavering, constant, and guiding principle that shaped everything. Begin's life was selfless devotion to his people, the Jewish people. It was a life in which it was a life in which determination eradicated fear, hope overcame despondency, love overcame hope, and devotion to both Jews and human beings everywhere coexisted with ease and grace. It was more than anything a life of great loyalty to the people into which he was born and to the state that he helped create. That is the legacy, infinitely greater than most are able to bequeath. In an era in which many are increasingly dubious about the legitimacy of love for a specific people or devotion to an ancestral homeland, the life and commitments of Menachem Begin urge us to take a look at what he did and what he stood for, and to imagine, if we dare, the glory of a Jewish people recommitted to the principles that shaped his very being. Wow. Menachem Begin, one of the greatest prime ministers that Israel ever had.